Yep.
That makes it even better.
Yeah. I could promote, promote something that's not.
For those of you that got here a little early. It's not even early anymore. For those that got here, that are here, there are some books up here in the front. Excuse me. I got a nice little grant from Thrivent, as they tend to do. Thrivent is a mutual funds, you know, plan for your retirement organization, known to a lot of Lutherans, maybe not known outside those circles, I'm not sure. But these books will be given away, and I'm going to pass around. Unfortunately, the grant did not cover enough for everybody. But if you want to take a look at them, and then I'm going to pass around, I'm going to pass around a thing tomorrow, and somehow we'll figure out a drawing. So if you want to take a look at them today, either right now, at the beginning of class, if you want to grab one and look at it, or take a look at it tomorrow after class, if you think you might be interested, that would be great. Also, I have business cards that I just had made, just for Holden, that you, if any of you would like to stay in touch with your big, deep questions that we would have fun discussing, or if you want me to come to your church to do something similar to this, please take one and let me know. This is actually the first time I've put together this presentation as a whole, though my friends who accompanied me through seminary know that I talk about this stuff all the time. If you want to talk about bringing me to your church, let me know, and I would love to do that. So, or if you just want to stay in touch with, you know, questions that may come up later. I do ask that if you take a book, that you take it with a commitment that you will do something with it. And something that involves being out somewhere maybe where you haven't been, or in the communities that these books talk about, or that you'll do this kind of work. I have learned again and again from my friends who are people of color that white people like to have book studies, is a comment I've heard. that, you know, we get fired up over, oh, I need my glasses on, that's why. Glasses, lenses. We get fired up about things, but because we are people of privilege, which is not a slam, it is a reality. We have the privilege of being concerned from a distance, those of us who identify as white. So I do ask that if you sign up to take a book, you think about where that might take you next. And that is also part of what I commit to for you, that if you want to take your book and then be in conversation via email or FaceTime or whatever over that after Holden Village, we can do that. So that is that. This is my mom. This doesn't apply to class, but my mom and my cute niece. And I just love this picture. My mom is, well, as you can see, she's got quite the green thumb. And though she can't do as much digging around in the world as she used to do, the pots on her decks are really good. Just for kicks, I'll show you this picture. I use this picture occasionally to illustrate what it means to say, I don't see color, or I don't see disability, you're just a person to me. Why wouldn't we see color? You know, look what we're missing. And when we say I don't see color, we're just saying that I see you as me and I don't have to do anything then. But look at the beauty that when we decide to admit that we do see color and we do see disability and we do see the things that are different from us. Maybe we are a disabled person. Maybe we are, you know, and we want to be seen. Maybe we are someone who is LGBTQAI+. Maybe we are someone who is a woman or who is a person of color in a white retreat center or white society. Of course, we want to be seen as well. And so, anyway, that is such a tangent, though. Thank you for letting me show you my family.
Beautiful tangent.
I want to touch on, I want to touch on Jubilee for just a second. Let me find where we're going to start, though. Okay. Actually, we'll start here. I want to touch on Jubilee for a second. We are talking about, what are the three R's of Jubilee? Because I can't remember. Oh, what are they?
Release, renew, and return.
We release. You know, you can't be holding on to things if you want to take in something new or if you want to work on something. I am famous for this because I do have trouble walking, and so when I'm going to go from here to there, I want everything I need in one trip. But then sometimes, like, I have to open the door. Or so you can't hold, we can't hold all the things. We have to let go sometimes of some things to allow other things in. And release, return,
renew.
Once we find that we are letting things in, it might mean we have to return to our own, what our lenses are made of, where our social location puts us, our own past. I have always known a lot about my Italian ancestors because I grew up with those first generation, my dad, the first generation who was my dad, and were my aunts and uncles. And I grew up in the area they grew up in Western Pennsylvania. So, you know, of course I heard the lore of how Grandpa Pino Antonio Pino, supposedly, he fought in World War I. He was here very young doing coal mining. There's a lot to go into there, but there were more Italians coming back and forth at the beginning of the 20th century than anyone. And they did go back and forth. They were called Birds of Flight, I think, something like that. So he came over a couple times, worked in the coal mines, went back. somewhere in there, he signed up at like 17 for the army, and he fought in World War I at the end of it. Well, supposedly the lore is that when World War II came about, Mussolini wanted him for all his secrets.
Uh-oh.
And so he escaped by cover of night to own a ship to come back here and work. I don't know if that's true, but it's a good story. I did not know a lot about my German ancestors, except that they landed in Minnesota somewhere, and they were a few more generations removed. And it was only really in seminary where I started doing work with anti-racism and justice work that I realized that I am a direct beneficiary of the Homestead Act. Which should have been obvious somewhere in high school when I learned that about that, but that they received free farmland that was taken from someone else. And so, you know, the bonds that I cashed from my grandfather to go to college, the inheritance I received from great aunts when they passed, or from my own aunt, my mom's sister, when she passed, I need to think about, you know, I needed to think about those things. And what does that mean now that I am the beneficiary of these things that were taken, you know, you can draw a direct line. So release, return, think about not only what we are giving back, but also how we are returning to shalom, the shalom that is intended for us, apparently by the first and second creation orders. And then, you know, renew. What do we do with all that? Where does that go? I would like to try to model that today here in our class. I have noticed in most of the sessions I've been to that the people who speak up first are often the men. And I think we are wired for that. I think men, if you've done any work in privilege, you know that through no fault of your own, if you're a white man, you were born into this society where there aren't a lot of hindrances in your way. I mean, of course there are. There are health issues. There's poverty that you may have grown up in. But your skin color and your, if you present as a man, meaning people look at you and they assume that's what you are, that gives you a leg up on a lot of things. And if that doesn't make sense, we can talk about that after. White Women, we're kind of next in line. And of course, there are a lot of other things in there. If where you fall on the gender spectrum, whether you're abled, disabled, what class you fall into. But I would like to, in the spirit of Jubilee, I would like to turn to bring things closer together. You know, in Luke, when it says, Gospel of Luke, and in throughout Isaiah and other places, where it says the rough places will be made plain, the mountains will be made low, the low places lifted up. That doesn't mean things are being obliterated. It just means things are being brought closer together. And so what I would like to try to model today is, let's see if we can do that. That women, we are socialized to speak second and to make way for men. Again, this is what we're born into if we grew up here and if we're white. So I would just like to invite, after Lars asks his question, I would like to invite us to look around the room and identify people who are lower on the privilege scale than us, and to not speak until they have spoken. Which might mean, you know, you feel put in a weird position if you're a woman who doesn't want to speak. But I would like to try that too. Yes, Lars.
So do you want us white men to shut the hell up?
No, that's not what I'm saying. See, and that's how we've been socialized to think, right? That if you're asked to try something different, it means that you're not in the conversation at all. And that's not it.
Okay.
You get to be invited to listen, which is also being part of the conversation. So, and also, you know, yes, to speak up. But let's make some space, and let's just make space for people who haven't talked yet, too. I know I'm a person who always has, especially in these kind of conversations, obviously, I'm up here with a mic. But, yeah, let's just have space for those who haven't spoken yet. So, unless you have to, like, go to the bathroom or I have a bug on me, you may speak up then. So, yesterday, I talked about... I don't even remember. Was it yesterday, the day before? I think the day before. We talked about the source theory, where scholars have done the work with the language and the form, the way things are written in the various writings of the Bible, to figure out maybe where they have come from. That they are not just a flat, timeless collection of writings, that they are in fact a collection of writings that span the stories of which and the words in which span generations. And so people have done the work to see where they come from. And if you remember, they were, you don't have to remember this, but JEPD is the four-letter thingy that people use to remember that. But J stands for Yahwist, because German theologians were the people who did a lot of this first work, and J in German is apparently the Y-ish sound. So Yahwist, E is Elohist, and that has to do with the name. These have to do with the names that God is called in various pieces. And then the priestly writers, which have to do with people we're going to talk about, those in exile. And then D is the Deuteronomist. And this is probably the last writer. Deutero means second. So this is the last writer who kind of looked at some of the histories and put them all together in Deuteronomy. So if you want to say something fun and smart when you go back, you can talk about the Deuteronomistic histories. The Deuteronomistic histories. We're going to talk about the priestly writers. So I just touched on this yesterday, that the cosmology, the theological cosmology, the view of all that is and all we cannot see, of the early Israelites is henotheism. And we saw this when people read from the book of Job and from was it Psalm 95, I think, and some other places, the ones that are right up there, 2 Kings. We saw this in that the deity of Israel has a council. Also, that deity is named what they call the Tetragrammaton, which, geek note, really shouldn't have, these are vowels. These little things underneath are the vowel markers. Should not have those, because it actually is, because of the rules of grammar, which I don't understand, but somebody told me, and I believe them, that It is an unpronounceable name. Because of the rules of grammar, Jay's agreeing, so I believe it's true. Because of the rules of grammar, it is actually an unpronounceable name. So it has been rendered in my, I think I spelled it wrong, Yahweh. Does it have an H? Y-A-H? Anyway, you know what? They didn't have an H, so neither does that. So Yahweh had a council of advisors, including HaSatan, the adversary, who long after the final form of the Old Testament and the Newer Testament is embodied or personified as Satan by church leaders who wanted to strike the fear of God into people. But HaSatan is part of God's council, along with angels and other beings. When the nations were at war, so were their gods. Or when the gods were at war, so were their nations. And the outcome here on earth reflected the outcome of the cosmological sphere. And I asked you yesterday, what did it mean then that, not the Judah, that Judah was defeated by Babylon and that the temple was destroyed? If we think of this cosmology and that the people of Israel saw their God being at war with the people of Babylon or whoever was assailing them, what does it mean that they lost?
Their God lost.
That their God lost, yep. Yeah, where is God is a huge question for those in exile. We talked yesterday about how after the war, the kind of the 1%, the wealthy and the literate, the artists, the priests, the leaders were taken away to Babylon and the common folk were left behind. And so the question that we see reflected in the scriptures of these people is, what happened? Where was God? How could this happen? The exile in Babylon exposes the exiled ones also, as all this is happening, to a more advanced culture. I'm not sure advanced is the right word, because that places a value on certain ways of being. And so, but to a culture that had existed for a lot longer. They had libraries. I talked about Babylonian library, also the Egyptian library at Alexandria, very famous, copious, even that they had written records, written materials that were organized and kept as records of the past and kept their stories. Great value is placed on the written word, on written communication, that kind of thing. So as the priests of, you know, who were there, you know, they had their, like at Holden, we have our first day where we kind of relax and then we get down to business. They probably had, you know, a time of mourning and thinking maybe they were going back. And as they realized exile is going to last for a while, this is how I interpret it. I think that they recognized their role as pastoral caregivers for a people in trauma. Because what they commit themselves to is the preservation of their identity, the reimagining and rearticulation of their traditions, and of their theology, of their God talk. So Babylon's culture of literacy and literature and, get out of your way, lovers, mythology, offer them a way to tend to both of those concerns, care for the people and preservation of identity. And they begin to write down their tradition. I imagine the conversation was something like, hey, we're in diaspora now. We're not all neighbors anymore. How are we going to save these traditions for people who are not close geographically anymore and preserve them through time? So a great example of this is in Genesis 1. I was going to have you go through Genesis 1 and 2, but I think for the sake of time, we'll just talk about it. For those who know Genesis 1, can you quote some things from it? Like, just shout out. What are some of the...
In the beginning.
In the beginning.
Which proves it's a book about baseball.
In the beginning. Yep. In the beginning, God created heavens and the earth, right?
Yeah.
And how does that God create?
Speaking.
Sorry?
Speaking.
Just by speaking, right. And God said, let there be
light.
God said, let there be... Yeah, we remember that. Other things. Let there be cats and rhinoceroses and, you know, mosquitoes. I don't know why, God. We got a question about that one. But and God said, let there be, and there was, and it was
good.
No, before that, it was, oh, no. There yeah, it was good, and then it was
very
no, it was evening. Yeah, it was very good. I'm thinking about it was evening and morning the first day. And then it was evening and morning
the second day.
And et cetera. And then when humanity is created, so it was good is tov. Tov is the word for good. All these things are tov. And when humanity is created, and how is humanity created?
Man.
What's that?
From the earth.
In Genesis 1, how is...
God's image.
Genesis, see, this is where it gets interesting to pull them apart. In Genesis 2, which is a much older story, the thought is Genesis 2 comes from the tradition around the time of King David. God's name in Genesis 2 is that...
Hello.
That name, the Lord, which is often translated as the Lord God. God's name in Genesis 1 is Elohim. Mm-hmm. And that you'll see rendered as God. So in Genesis 2, humanity is created through the earth and then through taking the rib. Interestingly, humanity has no gender until a second human is born. It's the earth creature. In Genesis 1, though, God says, let us create humanity in our own image. And there they are, man and woman. So Genesis 1 comes to us from this priestly source. And a really interesting study is to look at the Enuma Elish, which is Babylon's creation epic. All that was in, so the priests are in Babylon, they're reimagining how do we care for these people whose God has defeated us. All that was created, according to the Enuma Elish, over the span, takes place over a span of a vast epic war among the deities of Babylon, culminating in Marduk's defeat of Tiamat, the chaos monster, who I think was his grandma. There's kind of that, like in Greek mythology, there's the original deities, of which Tiamat was one. She got married to somebody, they had kids. Marduk is, I think, the third generation. Marduk is asked, Tiamat gets really mad because somebody killed her husband. As I said up there, it's like Dallas plus Game of Thrones on steroids. chaos, jealousy, deceit, violence, vengeance. This is the Babylonian myth. And I found, I just could not resist this. This is from a website called Storyboard This. And you see in the first, that's okay, I'm just going to sit while I'm talking about it. In the first, everybody's white, first of all, sad but true. It's a little out of focus, but the people on the left, somebody's asking Marduk, take care of Tiamat. Tiamat's over in the corner, she's sad and mad because her husband's been killed. So in the second one, Marduk says, yes, I will do it. And then the third one you see, he's confronting Tiamat, the chaos monster. Oh, that's for the bus, for our folks who are leaving. And you can see her realm of chaos there. She says, you know, I'm mad and I'm going to do stuff. And then he defeats her in the lower left. And then he's all happy and everybody's like, yay, we're going to make you our god. And then Marduk, the way heavens and earth are created is that he rips Tiamat's body apart.
Ooh.
And that becomes the heavens and the earth.
Oh, wow.
I know. So here is, this is an etching from a ruin in Nimrod, which I didn't know, I just thought that was, we used to call each other Nimrods as an insult as kids.
Yeah.
Is that right? This is an etching from a plate found there of Marduk and Tiamat, the chaos monster. A little different from our little cartoon version.
But chaos really wasn't defeated.
Well, this is this. Well, yeah, but we're not Babylonian either. So this is our, this is their myth. So the priestly writers, they saw this going on in Babylon, and also, you know, they were living alongside these people who believed this was, these were their gods. They were being coerced to worship them. You know, that is part of conquest, is you become like us, at least for the Babylonians. So the priestly writers reframed their origin story to cast their god as Elohim, which means the god above all the gods. Whenever you see A, or I am on the end of a word in Hebrew, that's plural. El, you may know, is God. I don't know what O is. Elohim, so like cherubim, seraphim, those are plural. So Elohim can also mean, can mean God, can mean gods, all the gods, and it can mean the God above all gods. So by calling their God Elohim, they could sound to their captors like, yeah, they're talking about gods, our gods. But they were talking about, and so that's why in Psalm 95, Lars, that you read yesterday, I think, you read the King's
read
one.
Kings.
Who read Psalm 95? Somebody did. And where it talks about, he is a great king above all gods. And then later it says, for he is our God, and we are his people, the sheep of his pasture. This is my Missouri Synod background. This was part of our liturgy, so it rings really familiar. If you read that as, so he is our God, we are the people of his pasture. If you don't emphasize our, if you say, for he is our God, you might be getting a little closer to what the original writers, those priests and those psalmists that were trying to keep the tradition, what they were doing. So this God in Genesis is transcendent. God only has to speak. There's no warfare, there's nobody else involved. Only needs to speak to make things happen. And creation is orderly. And God said, let there be, and there it was, and it was good, evening, morning, day one. It was orderly, no chaos monster. And best of all, I love this part. As Brittany said, you, O exiled one, O traumatized, defeated, slave in exile, you were created in the image of this God. Doesn't that just, I get chills when I think about that. You see what I mean about pastoral care? That these were people who had been traumatized deeply. I mean, a trauma that lasted, that became part of their identity, a historical injury, historical trauma that lasted and became identifying. Think of how this must have felt. To start reimagining, start theologizing, talking about God in a way that helped them, even in their space there, to become a transcendent, conquering people. Yes, Lars.
You said there was no chaos, but there was chaos before God
took
charge.
Yeah, you know, there's...
remember, like it says about...
When the earth was dark and void.
Dark and void.
Something like that.
Yeah,
the Hebrew for that is something like Tohu Vavohu. It's very poetic.
There was no order.
So the debate with biblical scholars and theologians was creation, did it come out of nothing? Or did it come out of pre-existing something? Another session here at Hope.
Yeah.
So P also, the P I call them, my friends the priests, they also retroject both victory and culpability into their texts. So they, even though Israel was a small, beleaguered nation that was always looking over their shoulder for who was going to come at them next, in their scriptures, they are painted as the victors. So you have the narrative of Moses and Pharaoh becoming a central narrative. You can see why, right? Here's the conquering king, the conquering ruler in the empire. And then here are the little scrappy Israelites who defeat, whose God defeats that king over and over. Joshua leveling and taking Canaan, leveling Jericho, taking Canaan. All those stories of warfare there's a saying that I learned from my teachers in seminary that all stories are true. Some of them actually happened. I think that's been attributed to Maya Angelou, though I think it's also been attributed to other folks as well. All stories are true. Some of them actually happened. And if we were doing if we had another week to get together and do this, we'd talk about why those stories are in there. You know, why did the people who created the final form after the exile, the final form of the Hebrew scriptures, why do they include both creation stories, even though they contradict? Why do they include Chronicles and Kings, even though some of their things contradict? You know, in the New Testament, we have both Galatians, where Paul talks about himself and never mentions falling off a horse, which you'd think he would. And then in Acts, we have Paul as a character who is created for a different purpose. We see that in movies all the time, right? Like, we see characters that we know historically never... Abraham Lincoln Vampire Slayer is a movie. And it calls upon, you know, the virtue of Abraham Lincoln to create this whole myth about how he actually was a vampire slayer. It's a way, that's a little more entertaining way, but it's a way of telling a truth. And it's a way that may seem foreign to us because we're people of fact, right? Somebody was asking me about the facts don't back up this or that. And that may be true. But that was not what was important to people of these times as in this culture. What was important was creating a larger narrative that told some truths they needed to tell about God and about God's relationship to them. So both victory and culpability. In the Book of Kings, these books that were compiled and written during and after the exile, they also talk about how it's the people's fault. Because they had to reconcile, how could our God be the God above all gods and yet be the God that was defeated? And so it got spun as it is our fault for disobeying, and God had no other way to teach us but to let the chips fall where they may, so to speak. I don't know how to say that in Hebrew, but I'm sure it's there somewhere. And the exiles also institute or reemphasize traditions in real life, like in the moment in Babylon, to maintain a separate identity. So I have no idea why, but circumcision predates the exile, but continues to be a marker, an ethnic marker. dietary codes, purity code, you know, we're going to eat only certain things. We don't eat the food of our captors. Purity codes, this is how we stay ritually clean. This is how we worship. And Sabbath, I love that they consecrated time. So they no longer have a temple, right? So what do? They say, place doesn't matter. Time is what matters. And we have that. So instead of consecrating a place where God lives, they consecrate time. And they have this, they reinforce this, or they create this idea of Sabbath. And then all that, when they're starting to write down their stories, it gets retrojected, not projected, but retrojected into their stories. So we see Abraham circumcising his sons, and we see the dietary laws at work, and we see Sabbath at work. So that it becomes part of their narrative and their history as they're collecting their stories and creating their holy texts, the library of their holy texts. Moses, as I said, becomes a central narrative. There are also these hilarious narratives like Daniel and later Esther that satirize the empire. I think Daniel could be a hilarious story if it's told in the right way and not in the Sunday school, you know, the way I learned it, which was, and then the lion did not eat them, and then the guards fell in. Like, think of the Roadrunner. You know how the Roadrunner always did stuff to trap, if you know this cartoon, the Wile E. Coyote would always buy his dynamite from the Acme dynamite place. He'd set the trap. It would never work till what? Till he went to check it out, and then it would blow up in his face. So in Daniel, you have, you know, these three Shadrach, Meshach, Abednego, and then Daniel, these three beautiful Hebrew boys who will not bow down to the king. They're put in the fiery furnace. Nothing happens. And the captors are like, what? How come they're not burning up? And they lean over, and then they fall in. And then later, the lion's den, Daniel's put in there, not eaten up. And they go, what? And they go to check it, and then they get... I mean, think of how hilarious that would have been. Violent, yes, but hilarious. To the people in exile, like, it's not going to work. Here comes a coyote to check out his pile of dynamite. Ah, it blew up in his face. That Bible's hilarious. And Esther, I mean, Esther's a great book. Esther is the same way, where, you know, you have these plans and plans and plans made by Haman. They all backfire. Spoiler alert, in the end he goes to beg her forgiveness, but he falls, and right at that moment the king walks in, and it looks like Haman is laying on top of Esther. So the king's like, you go get hanged on the gallows you built. So, see, funny. After the exile, the now written records of Israel's sacred stories are added to redacted, which means edited. They're, things are added, things are taken away, they're polished up, until reaching their final form. So here's our collection of scriptures. Sometime during the Persian exile, it's a long span that they were working on this. But as the temple was being rebuilt, they're also working on a more sophisticated-ish, if one wants to say that, like the next step. They are modeling things after what they learned in Babylon, and they're creating their own library of texts that can also be shared within the diaspora, which is out there. Not everybody comes back from Babylon. We talked about that yesterday, right? There's also a diaspora that ends up in Egypt. So, you know, this Judaism, though it's not called that yet, is starting to spread, or has continued to spread. As I said yesterday, I'm an Old Testament scholar, and I realized last night, like, we should probably talk about the New Testament for a minute. So, for that, though, are there any questions? Remembering our Jubilee order of conversation, are there any things to add or say? All right, hold on. I'm going to hear from a woman first. Or someone who identifies as a woman. We'll say it that way. Who? Oh, Enuma Eilish. That I do not know. I'll have to do some deep, that's my next thesis. I'll do some deep research. Yes, Claire.
In the kind of the Elohim rewrite Genesis 1, like we're writing that, not over against the Babylon story, but was there a sense in that period of time that the deity of that nation was becoming less warlike? I mean, was this a transition away from the kind of like warlike God and this like our God can speak, there was no war in our creation, or was that an aberration in the overall, like, God still likes war?
Well, that's a good question. I would think probably not. Maybe there was a broadening of God's
interests.
There you go. Yeah, God's wheelhouse becomes bigger. Because God is envisioned as transcendent above all the other gods, perhaps, you know, like Obi-Wan Kenobi, these little ones are not worth the trouble, you know. But certainly in rendering the stories of the Exodus, there's a lot of violence that goes on there at the bequest of God. To, you know, if you want to read an interesting take on the Exodus story, Robert Warrior is a Native American theologian and writer, and he has an essay called Canaanites, Cowboys, and Indians, maybe? It's got Canaanites and Cowboys in it. And he talks about how the Exodus story is not a story for Native Americans. The story of the Canaanites, the ones who were displaced from their land, is the story for the Native Americans. So how do you reconcile that if you're having conversations, theological and biblical conversations between cultures. You know, for us, our at least our historical ancestors here in this country, we were all about also envisioning ourselves as Israel, right? That manifest destiny, this was the promised land. The Canaanites were the Native Americans, we agreed on that. And God had sent us to obliterate them. So, you know, how we use the Bible, there's a lot of history there depending who you are. But yeah, that's a great question. I don't know the answer to that, but I would imagine that as we talk about Hellenism, we'll talk about moving into a more Greek philosophical frame of mind in general in these areas, and as Palestinian civilization continued to move forward. And I would imagine that that probably is a little more of what dissipated the emphasis on war and created more of an emphasis on beautiful things like how we live together and salvation. Though the empire was always there. So you had the zealots in Jesus' time who were like, you know, we're looking for a warrior king, and that sect of Judaism. So somebody in the back had a question.
It just strikes me with this editing and rewriting. Mm-hmm. So I come from a more scientific scholarly mm-hmm. tradition. But, you know, that being that process of writing a scholarly manuscript where you come back and there is still that central message you're trying to get across. And one thing I was taught in writing is you know you're done editing when you get back to something close to your first version and you say the same thing. This just strikes me as that of, like, this initial maybe truth or message that went through this revision and they finally got back to where they started and they're like, yep, that's good.
Yeah, I sure would love to, since I'm very fascinated by the Babylonian captivity and the, just the effect, the huge effect it had on what we have received. And you can see it, you know, in places where the people are described as disobedient, you know, and these old stories are now used to frame a narrative that is continually leading to God's faithfulness. And yeah, I love that. But you know, they move forward by going back and finding their traditions. They don't create a whole new thing. They find their traditions and they add to those and they polish those up and make them a longer narrative. That's a great, yeah, thank you for that.
And kind of connected to that, did you say who was the source of this Genesis 2 version?
Genesis 2 is the Yahwist, that's J.
Okay.
Because of the name for God, also because of how it's written. There are apparently a lot of puns, and the Yahwist loves puns. So, like, when the earth creature is named Adam, the Hebrew is something like Adam for mud being. And then, I know. And so the name becomes that thing. And there apparently are a lot of very clever turns of phrase and puns and things like that with the Yahwist. So there are form called literary and form criticism. There are things that those folks look at to find that out. And the name for God is kind of a giveaway. If you want to do something really fun, I mean, this is better than hiking. If you want to do something really fun, take a look at the Noah's Ark narrative, the flood narrative, and parse out where you see things similar to Genesis 1, like references to the firmament. In Genesis 1, the firmament is placed. This is why we point up for God and, you know, kalap, kalap, praising God. The firmament is placed to hold the waters of the heavens out. In Noah's Ark, that tears apart, and that's what makes the flood. Read Genesis 1, then read the Noah's Ark story. Find where it's called God and find where it's called the Lord. And just, you have two different stories that are put together. And it works kind of well, but then there are things like Noah shuts the door to the ark. God seals up the door to the ark. You know, and so what? People hearing that in that time of in those places, they know that these are both our stories and they're all important. So that, and the Yahwist comes from They date it kind of around the time of King David, which is like 1,000, so 500 years before the exile. But yeah, that's a super, super fun.
Better than,
like ice cream, exegeting the Noah's Ark story,
oh, wow.
And the M&Ms that Brittany brought, but,
oh, yeah.
that she keeps providing for us. Yes, Carol.
If you like that sort of thing, you can get a book where they've done the color coding.
Amazon, here I come. Yeah, that's what we did in seminary is we, we would use colored pencils. That was a required thing in our book list, colored pencils. I went to a very cool seminary. And, you'd mark, yellow for this. And we did it the same in the New Testament when we looked at the synoptic. Yesterday I talked about the Gospel, Mark, Matthew, and Luke, Matthew and Luke borrow so heavily from each other and also from Mark, the first gospel. And we did a lot of color coding there too. It's fun. Bible stuff is fun. All right, we skip ahead to 3, we're moving right through the millennia here. Alexander, we talked yesterday about how he conquers that huge empire from India all the way to Europe. That ushers in the Hellenistic era. Hellas is the Greek word, I think it's Hellas, is it Hellas? Greek word for Greece. And the culture of Greece made its way through Alexander to all of these places. And even the Roman Empire stuck to the Hellenistic culture and revered that. So that that meant things like Greek was the language, the lingua franca, the language of the empire, and it brought in things like philosophy, not necessarily talking about theology, but philosophy. What is the meaning of life? How do you be, what is the ideal man? There were no ideal women, but what is the ideal man? Educated, artistic, articulate, schooled in rhetoric, the way you talk good when you're making an argument, excellence, beauty. And so, as we recall, in 63, Pompey of Rome took over Jerusalem. And that is why all the writings that we receive in the Newer Testament, they come out of that imperial context of Hellenism. I'm really whipping through this fast. Though his empire split after his death, and was eventually taken by Rome, Hellenism persists as the divining imperial culture, and so Greek becomes the language of the diaspora, and Palestinian Jews in urban settings, educated folks, maybe not the farmers who Aramaic was also in there as a trade language. But speaking Greek was how you got along in this empire. And especially those with status and wealth. One of my professors who was from the Philippines talked about how you can tell that someone, the class someone comes from in the Philippines. Because if you're lower class, you speak more languages. Because you're engaging with far more people. I think that's true. The higher our privilege is, we talked earlier, the language of listening and speaking is a learned language. And the higher your privileges, maybe the less conversant we are as white people in listening to those not like us, as among gender, even as adults with kids, right? Adults with teenagers, there's a different language. There was a nod and a very knowing look shared. So what this means is in Egypt, this diaspora of Jews in Egypt, right around the beginning of the Common Era, they observed the library in Alexandria, and there was this program to translate the Old Testament into Greek. And the product of that is called the Septuagint, which means 70, It comes from a legend of how many people worked on it, and supposedly all of how many men worked on it. Supposedly all of them came to the same exact translation. And then, just to put this in a time frame, the Septuagint, which is this is the Roman 70, would have been a great birthday gift for Jesus, because this is around the time when he is born as well, at the beginning of the before Common Era, and the beginning of the Common Era. So all the texts in the New Testament were written in Greek, and the reason I'm hammering on this is that it is likely that the Septuagint was the scripture of the people we hear from in the Bible. When Paul talks about the scriptures, he's not talking about the New Testament. He's not talking about the Bible. He's talking about what's called the Tanakh, the Hebrew scriptures. And it is likely that, you know, he wrote in Greek. It's likely he may not even have spoken Hebrew, except maybe in worship settings. And especially as more Gentiles joined the way, the Jewish sect that became Christianity. So though it concerns the life and ministry, theology, Christology, ecclesiology of a Jewish man named Jesus who spoke Aramaic, the Newer Testament is colonized in that we recognize that it is rendered in the language of the conquerors. And this is kind of the point of the course, that we receive the Bible always, always filtered through empire. What we receive, not only linguistically, but theologically, you know, as Hellenism became the culture of the land, it also became the culture of the people who wrote the scriptures for us. Not for us. Who wrote the scriptures? So like the book of Luke, again, I'm not a huge Greek scholar, but the book of Luke is and Acts, which really are one piece, Luke, Acts, supposedly it's just a wonderfully, beautifully written piece. And who is Luke, who is Luke and Acts dedicated to? Theophilus. Theo meaning God. And Philo meaning
love.
Lover of God. But it's not in Hebrew. It's Theophilus, this Greek lover of God. And at the same time, you know, the Gospel of Luke really leans on the Davidic tradition. You know, you have just as Samuel was born to an older priestly couple, or an older couple, so is John born to an older couple, impossible pregnancies. And where is Jesus born? Bethlehem, the city of David, and there are all these things that call in the Hebrew traditions as the church continues to move forward. All right, we're almost through the slides. The gospel reflects this colonization in their subtext, the gospels. They don't come right out and say, Rome is bad, revolt, reject them. But there certainly is a lot of Jesus talking about an alternative kingdom, right? The kingdom of God is like, you have heard, blah, 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 but the kingdom of God, which of course is what gets him executed, right? He is an enemy of the state for these words about an alternate kingdom, about a God who is father rather than Caesar being the father. And then by the end, just to touch on all the way through, you know, you have Paul writing to these growing churches. Some scholars think that Paul was really expecting Jesus to come right back. So Paul is a lot about how do you behave in the meantime? And then you have what's called the Deutero-Pauline letters. This is going to be, I need to deliver this gently. Deutero means second. Many of the letters traditionally ascribed to Paul are actually not written by him. There's evidence they came much later. The language is different. And in many of those, so like 1 Thessalonians, I think Philippians, Philemon, 1 and 2 Corinthians, Romans, I think maybe Galatians, one other. Galatians, thank you. Are pretty much agreed on that Paul wrote those. And then the other ones were written by probably students of people that kept the school of Paul going. And so ascribed to him as well. But you can see in those a little different, like, it's no longer hang in there till Jesus comes back. It's more like, here's how we get along with each other for the long haul. And so you see a different frame of mind. And then Revelation is, just to jump way ahead, the last book written that we know of till the next turn of the spade. And it is interpreted in many ways, but from an academic point of view, it is an indictment of Rome. That it's a collection of letters brought together to create kind of this one book, letters to these churches to encourage, hang in there, stay the course. And then there's all this imagery of how God would view Rome, the beasts and the chaos and all that they bring. But God in the end will be triumphant. Whew. That was the New Testament. We spent like 3 days on the Old Testament. Yeah, Lars.
Do we know anything about Tarsus? What was it? Was it an intellectual city? Was there a university?
That I don't know. It was a port city. I know that. So
port
Paul
city.
Would have, growing up in Tarsus, would have been exposed to a lot of multiculturalism.
Okay.
That I don't know.
He was a
Pharisee, so there was sort of that school of training.
Yeah.
And then, you know, being in the Hellenistic era, you know, probably schooled in rhetoric, obviously literate.
Sure.
And schooled in the Hebrew scriptures, which, you know, come up in his writings.
And we know he's a Roman citizen.
That's what it says, yeah.
Yep.
Roman citizen?
Yep.
So what do you have to do to be a Roman citizen?
That part I don't know. I'm a little fuzzy on that.
Okay.
You know, there are claims about Paul in Acts. I think I said this yesterday. And then there's what Paul says, or maybe I just said it this morning. and then there's what Paul says about himself. And I can't remember where that falls. But okay. Yeah. There. Yes.
Thank you for, I'm ashamed to say that I have never before considered your point that the New Testament was written in the language of the colonizers.
Mm.
I've never made that connection.
Oh, yeah.
So in as this story continues, the language of the colonizers is used to squash the diversity of voices that mm-hmm. are made. At the same time, it's an opportunity to speak to the colonizers.
Mm-hmm.
So can you help me understand a little better what you're saying is going on here with the New Testament writings?
Yeah, I'm really whipping through it kind of fast, huh?
In terms of the engagement of the empire.
The New Testament writings are not written for the empire. They are written for the people whose movement becomes Christianity. So, you know, early on, like in the time of Paul, the Jews who are now struggling with what do we do with Gentiles who appear, you know, who want to be part of this? Do they have to become like us and get circumcised? Is it enough to be of the same mind? And the Gospels were written for particular communities. We don't know which ones, but they each have kind of a different emphasis, you know, whether that's on whether that's on just telling the story or pointing to our heritage as Jews, or in the case of Luke, Acts, looking at telling the story. I like to think of it like this. Here's the manger, telling the story of how the church grows and becomes and goes out into the world. So I would say they're not really in conversation with the empire, but they're speaking in somewhat coded language as oppressed peoples do. So Jesus talks in parables and, you know, and says things like, those who get it, and those who don't. So that would be, I guess that would be my answer to that, my response to that. You know, when you look into the history of slave tradition here, there's a whole catalog of music that are the code songs, mm-hmm. you know, that they would sing right under the noses of the overseers and the owners that would talk about their escape plan. But because those people either could not imagine that these conquered folks could be that sophisticated, or just didn't know the language, it went past them. So that's kind of how I imagine what the writings, especially the Gospels, were about. Yeah, way in the back.
Yeah, as these books were curated, like you said, did they trend more conservative or more radical? Like, if we were to find things that were curated out, would they be even more surprisingly radical? Or?
Yeah, we'll talk about that tomorrow, but yes, what happens when Constantine, the Roman Emperor Constantine, adopts Christianity as the state religion is that they realize we need to rein this in. And so what happened was
Who are the we's that you're talking about?
Church.
Okay.
The church, yeah. So Constantine adopts Christianity, which formerly was a critic of the empire that oppressed and persecuted it. Now Christianity can't bite the hand that feeds it, right? So what happened was a lot of writings were left out of what we call the canon, which is the set of books we call the Bible. So what were selected, what made their way in were the books that generally agreed with the state theology. So you have these, you know, you've heard of like the Gospel of Thomas and the Gnostic Gospels, these other writings about Jesus that take a different viewpoint but didn't make it in because they didn't agree with what became the party line. So we'll talk about that some more tomorrow. That's a great question. We are close to the end. I feel like I just talked so much. We are at the end. So getting back to why we're here, just something to think about, and we'll talk about this tomorrow. How did the reality of empire throughout history, if we sum up, how did it influence the texts we receive from the ancient writers? And we'll talk about that tomorrow. Thank you for listening. It was a lot today in a short amount of time. So. Don't forget the flood narrative. Hiking.
Ice cream.
Have a great rest of the day. I'll see you tomorrow.
Thank you.
Yeah.